Hey there, a quick favor. We are conducting an audience survey, and we'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes and answer some questions in the survey. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to take the survey today. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. And thank you. Vladimir Putin declares martial law in parts of Ukraine illegally annexed by Moscow, a drastic assault on individual rights.
There is possibility to arrest everyone at the pleasure of military officers for up to 30 days.
Also today, China's unpredictable COVID lockdowns have choked the economy there. Small business owners are now looking to this week's Communist Party Congress to see whether restrictions might be lifted.
From the signals sent out so far, it's not going to happen.
Their frustration could threaten China's stability. I'm Marco Werman, plus a legal demand from a New Zealand lawmaker to government agencies speak clearly.
We have a democratic right to be able to understand this information.
Jargon is out, plain talk is in. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for joining us today. The declaration of martial law in any situation is a rare and momentous move. It means many laws are suspended and a country's armed forces essentially take over. Today, Russian President Vladimir Putin did just that. Putin declared martial law in four regions of Ukraine that Moscow partially and illegally annexed. He also gave officials additional emergency powers in six regions on the Ukrainian border and Crimea. To explore what all this could mean, we reached out to Kirill Karateyev. He's the head of international legal practice with the Russian human rights group Agora. Karateyev formerly lived and worked in Moscow. We're not disclosing his current location to protect his safety. Mr. Karateyev, what does the imposition of martial law in this case practically mean for these parts of Ukraine? What is Putin exactly doing?
The law allows for drastic restrictions on individual rights, and that may concern prohibiting you to live where you live, so you have to move, or you have to be called for labor related to the military, and there is military censorship, and there is possibility to arrest everyone at the pleasure of military officers for up to 30 days. So the restrictions are severe. Well, good thing is that there is an exhaustive list.
I mean, it's not as if the Russian military was respecting the rights of Ukrainian civilians before this declaration of martial law. How does this actually practically change things?
Well, already quite a lot of people were moved or were forced to move or had no other option than to move from Ukraine to very different regions of Russia, and that was Penza on the Volga region, but also the Far East and also the northwestern parts of the country. A lot of them were able to leave for European Union, and a lot of them still, I understand, wish to live for the European Union. But again, not everyone is able to travel to the border with, say, Estonia or Finland. So the magnitude of the new arrivals because of the resettlement, which we understand is ordered in Kherson at least, it may be impressive.
What does this declaration of martial law in these annexed regions of Ukraine, what does it mean for most people living in Russia? Would it have any impact on them?
So far, there are restrictions announced in connection with the martial law in the border regions of Russia, and heightened police patrols that are announced in the whole European center of Russia, which covers, you know, a few dozen of regions. And not every governor so far is eager to implement the most drastic restrictions. So the governors of the border regions were authorized, for example, to prohibit travel to certain locations, and quite a number of those already said they do not intend to.
Kirill Karateyev, you've been doing human rights law for many years. Did you find this announcement chilling and an especially worrying step?
Well, it escalates the situation. It imposes new restrictions, and we are going each day from February the more restrictive laws, and there are again no checks on the Russian executive power which it introduces them, or if necessary the parliament ratifies them with no questions asked. And that is the problem. The problem is when there are no checks on one of the powers, it tends to abuse it, as obvious as it is now, as it was to American founding fathers in the 18th century.
Kirill Karateyev is a lawyer with the Russian human rights group Agora, explaining the news today that Russian President Vladimir Putin declared martial law in the Ukrainian regions that Russia claims it has annexed. China is at the center of a drama playing out in the United Kingdom. On Sunday, several men came out of the Chinese consulate in Manchester, then beat up a Hong Kong pro-democracy activist. The man was dragged inside the consulate grounds and punched and kicked. Some of this was caught on video. The man who was beaten was taken to the hospital. British Foreign Secretary James Cleverly says he has not ruled out prosecuting or expelling Chinese officials for their actions. China is fighting back. I asked Chris Chung, a London-based reporter, what China is saying about Sunday's incident.
The latest version, actually from the Consul General himself, he said that there were people trying to storm the consulate and attack two staff of theirs, causing injuries, and that a protester was holding a staff's neck. So the staff was pulled by other staff back into the consulate, and that caused the protester to punch into the consulate.
What are the protesters saying in response?
The protesters say it was men who came out of the consulate trying to damage and take away their protest items, including two slogans attacking the Chinese Communist Party, as well as an image of Chinese President Xi Jinping, which the consulate called insulting. But the protesters said it was these men from the consulate who tried to take these items away, which caused the incident as they tried to stop the men from doing that. And then when they got close to the consulate's grounds, one of the protesters was dragged inside. And finally, he was able to be pulled out by one of the uniformed police who was present.
I mean, the video clips of what happened are online. It seems pretty clear what's going on. Is China disputing the visual evidence?
China actually is now publishing their own CCTV footage. But to some people, they actually show the same thing. Both of these videos show that one of the protesters was being dragged inside. I think what people can dispute is that whether staff of the consulate were being attacked as well. But then you can also argue these men, whether they were actually from the consulate or not, started the incident because they, the men who went outside to try to take away protesters' items. So it's hard to tell who's right, who's wrong for all these kind of things. But what's clear is that there was one man being dragged into the consulate's grounds and was attacked.
And what about the one detail, has this been confirmed, that China's consul general in the UK, Zhang Xiuwan, kicked down banners and forcefully grabbed the protester's hair before the protester was pulled inside the consulate grounds and beaten?
He actually told a local newspaper that he was present at the scene. Since the consul general, Zheng Xiyuan, has silver hair, he was wearing a hat, so he was quite clearly identifiable. If we believe that he was the guy in the video, then he kicked down one of the banners. He pulled the protester's hair at the gate of the consul grounds. If we believe that is him, then he has done the said things.
What is the British position at this point, Chris?
The British government has been saying that they need to wait for the investigation of the Greater Manchester Police, and then they will decide on what to do. The politicians, however, even people from the same ruling party and also the opposition party, have been very clear saying that they want the relevant diplomats or whatever people involved to be expelled from the UK. The challenge is that whether these people, if they are diplomats, can they be prosecuted by the UK laws, or can they be only declared persona non grata? That means they will be expelled from the UK.
Chris Chung is a London-based reporter speaking with us about the controversy in Manchester, UK, in which a protester was dragged inside the Chinese consulate grounds. Chris, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
China's Communist Party Congress is underway this week. Later this hour, we get a reality check on the hopes of some Chinese that COVID rules and other government restrictions might be relaxed after the Congress is over. More than 4 million Ukrainians have sought asylum in Europe since the start of Russia's invasion in late February. One country, Poland, has taken in far more Ukrainians than any other. It's accepted nearly 1.5 million people fleeing the war. But as Rebecca Rossman reports from Warsaw, local mayors say they're running out of money to support the newcomers, and many of the volunteers who turned up in the early months of the invasion say they're running out of energy.
Yes, we are in Warsaw's West Station.
It's rush hour, but traffic inside this railway station in central Warsaw is calm. Though my guide, Tsaveri Nalchievetsky, tells me that was hardly the case just a few months ago. Back in March, just outside this station, he and some friends started giving away homemade soups and sandwiches to Ukrainian refugees as they arrived.
During the busiest period, we served like 10,000 people a day.
The government eventually stepped in to provide funding, which helped them serve more than 500,000 people total. That is, until they were forced to shut down in mid-July because they ran out of money.
The government said that they can no longer support us financially.
He says part of that is understandable. Less Ukrainians have been coming into Poland compared to the start of the war. But with winter around the corner and Russia's recent barrage of missile strikes targeting key infrastructure and civilians, many expect a second, potentially even larger wave of refugees. Except now, there's a lot less money in the pot.
We need a much bigger funding for refugees.
Rafał Czekowski is the mayor of Warsaw. At a recent press conference, he blamed Poland's far-right central government for taking money away from larger cities like his, which are run by more liberal opposition parties.
So paradoxically, in times of crisis, instead of giving us money, the government actually focuses on taking money away from us. The Prime Minister Morawiecki a month ago said that the refugee crisis is over because most of the burdens were shifted our way, and it seems that the government doesn't have a strategy on helping refugees.
This has led to cuts to special benefits, such as free public transport for Ukrainian refugees and subsidies for people hosting them. Bartosz Koszecki is a member of the central government who works on the budget for refugees in Poland. He says that towns already have enough money and that the central government has already pledged $3.4 billion in aid for this year. While he agrees there could be more funding, he says that money should be coming from the European Union.
So this is the problem of Poland, because we have welcomed the most, the biggest number of the refugees, but it's also the matter of concerns to any other European countries. And that's what we're supposed to be financially covered and aid from the European Commission.
Then there's aid that has come from the Polish people. According to the Polish Economic Institute, private citizens spent as much as $2.1 billion helping Ukrainians in the first 3 months of the war. But now,
People are getting tired.
Helena Krajewska works with the Warsaw-based NGO Polish Humanitarian Action. We meet in a park in western Warsaw, where she says people are tired physically, mentally, and economically. She says what they need now is support.
Not only financial support, but even support, for example, support like saying, we are with you, we know that you already given a lot, and we are here to support your support to the refugees and to Ukraine.
But even with the fatigue, people like Tsaveri Nalchievetsky say they're prepared to rise to the challenge again.
It's an easy decision when someone is in need or is in pain. It's easy to find a strength to help.
The real obstacle is logistics and financing for such a big operation. But he's prepared to start his soup kitchen again, and he's confident the army of volunteers that showed up in the first months will mobilize with him. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman, Warsaw.
Just ahead, public scrutiny is putting the squeeze on the private jet habits of the rich and famous. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. One of the world's richest men has sold his private jet. Bernard Arnault, the co-founder of Louis Vuitton, says he sold his plane because climate activists on Twitter were tracing his flights and calculating his carbon emissions. Instead, Arnault says he will now be renting planes. Arnault isn't the only one who's been targeted. Climate activists want celebrities from Taylor Swift to Elon Musk to bring down their time in private jets. Joining me now is Sola Jung, an aviation researcher at the International Council on Clean Transportation. She's in San Francisco. Flying only accounts for around 2.5% of global greenhouse gas emissions, Sola. Luxury flying, even less. So why is this category of flying important to focus on from a climate perspective, do you think?
You're right. 2.5% does sound like a small number. But if we think about aviation as a country, it actually ranked right behind Japan, who's in the fifth place in terms of carbon emissions in 2019. And it will be slightly above Germany, who's in the sixth place. And that is just the scale of emission today. If we take into account the rapid growth of future demand, aviation can take up 12.5% of our 1.5 degree carbon budget between now and 2050. If we think about emissions from flying on an individual level, one round trip between East Coast and West Coast can take up more than half of someone's annual carbon emissions.
Right. So don't be deceived by the single-digit percentage of carbon emissions from flying. You recently authored a report about something called a frequent flying levy. What is that and how would that work?
So that's the idea where we place a climate tax on each ticket sold to consumers, and that tax would escalate as one person takes more flights in a year. So in our analysis, for example, your first flight of the year would be free. Your second flight would be taxed at a moderate $9. But if you take 20 flights that year, the 20th flight will be taxed at $177.
Is the idea of the levy also to kind of inhibit flying?
The levy was first proposed in the UK as a tool to manage demand, to curb flying. We took another angle, and we think that the levy can be purposed as a financing tool for decarbonizing aviation, because one of the key levers to reduce emissions is through sustainable aviation fuels, which currently cost 2 to 5 times more than conventional fossil jet fuel. So in order to quickly scale up those cleaner fuels, we think frequent flyer levy can be a relatively fair way to raise that fund.
So going back to Bernard Arnault of Louis Vuitton, his move to sell his private jet and just rent from now on, I mean, there is a trend of online activists tracking private planes and calling out celebrities on social media for short flights. Do you think this public shaming could have an impact on private flying?
It is definitely having an impact. I think a lot more people are paying attention to the problem. From the climate perspective, we are on a tight budget, and then the entire world is sharing that really tight carbon budget. Yes, those people have, you know, relatively important business to get to, but from the equity perspective, they're taking up a lot bigger of a share of the budget than the rest of the world. Flying is really a luxurious activity, and those a small subset of people able to benefit from this transport service is actually kind of stripping the rest of the world from their opportunity to travel affordably or sustainably.
Sola Jung is an aviation researcher at the International Council on Clean Transportation. She joined us from San Francisco. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Marshall.
2 rooms. That is the entire amount of space for a school in a village in Uganda. But for Project Shelter Wakadogo, that's about to change. The school won $250,000 in prize money in a global competition for underprivileged schools. Schools in Chile, the Philippines, Scotland, even here in the U.S. are also getting some badly needed cash. The prize money comes from a UK-based digital platform called T4 Education in a competition they call the World's Best Schools. Vikas Pota is T4 Education's founder and joins us from London. So I'd like to hear more about this one school in Uganda that was recognized, Vikas, Project Shelter Wakadogo. What's the story behind this school and how did it get your attention?
This school in Uganda has come through in our overcoming adversity category. And what's so special about it, everyone felt, was given the context of northern Uganda in particular and the civil war that ensued there, you know, what they've done is teachers, the school principal, the families in the community have put down guns and picked up pencils, chalk, and actually opted for education in a very positive and proactive fashion.
How do you expect Project Shelter Ouagadougou to use the money that they've won?
The Ouagadougou School has committed to creating a computer lab. What they want to do is bring a focus to this community about digital skills and technology skills. And having computers and hardware and a computer lab in their school is critical to that.
Can you imagine, Vikas, how this investment will benefit the children who attend Project Shelter Ouagadougou? How it'll benefit them in the long run?
I would love to say that this is an outlier and this is a very unique school. There's not many like it. But unfortunately, the state of the world today is such that there are many schools at the front line of many crises around the world. And what Ouagadougou does is bring a focus on, well, what is possible in that context and gives everyone hope and inspiration.
So are these public schools, for the most part, that are considered for the prize money? And are they in places where public education has gotten short shrift in recent years?
Well, the prizes are open to any school and every school. But what's really interesting is that in our first year, and we announced 5 school winners today, all 5 are public schools from around the world.
We were just reporting the other day on the cuts to public education in Brazil under President Jair Bolsonaro. How widespread is this problem? Are there certain parts of the world that you're focusing on where the problems are most acute?
Well, no, we're not focusing on any area. If you just take the example of Curie Metropolitan High School in Chicago, and you look at, it's been awarded a prize today in our Supporting Healthy Lives category, you look at its context, and I kid you not, but that school could be in any other disadvantaged and challenged part of the world. I think schools are challenged the world over, and I think we pay lip service to education, and so do politicians. Today, I'm really pleased to tell you that one of the schools from Chile, something quite spectacular just happened. We announced the prize this morning, and the president of the country has just visited the school and made a pronouncement about the scale-up of the practice of that school to all schools in Chile.
I was just going to ask you about that innovative school in Chile. Tell us about what they're doing.
During the pandemic, as a way of ensuring education continuity, they instituted a TV channel called Emilia TV. And that did more than just a continuity of lessons, but also led to, you know, their children actually advancing and through creativity and through their own energy, being able to make sure that they can hold the education community together, which I think was a real big challenge during the pandemic when we were isolated in our houses. But also the involvement of young people and empowering them to take charge, I think, is a really powerful message that's been sent.
Can a contest like yours, the world's best schools competition, can it change the discouraging statistics?
Well, just take what happened in Chile to just an hour ago. We're in a state of flux, and we have so many crises, and in fact, a crisis of confidence. We need better political leadership, and this shows that actually a prize is a great way of approaching systemic transformation in education.
Vikas Pota is the founder of T4 Education, a UK-based digital platform supporting educators and underprivileged schools across the globe. Vikas, I know you're traveling and in a busy airport. We really appreciate you sharing a few minutes of your day with us. Thank you.
You're very kind for this opportunity. Thank you so much.
You're listening to The World. In Iran, women and girls have led widespread protests for more than a month now. They're clear why they're taking to the streets. This young woman says she's striking back against outdated religious traditions that even members of her family embrace. She also knows that what she's doing is dangerous. Still ahead, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. China is all about economic growth. It has been for years. But right now, the Chinese government is doing something different. It's delaying the release of some key economic data, and that is leading to speculation that there could be trouble ahead for China's economy. From Shanghai, The World's China correspondent Rebecca Canther reports.
Over the past year, there's been a constant refrain here in China. After the Party Congress, the expression goes. And it means, once this week's big official meeting wraps up, things will get back to normal. Sunday's opening ceremony was live-streamed everywhere from bus stops to Buddhist temples. But while the party elite meets in Beijing and applauds for Chinese leader Xi Jinping, elsewhere, COVID lockdowns are still wreaking havoc. Small business owners are some of the hardest hit.
Zhang Mancheng and his wife run a small sushi restaurant on a cafe-lined street in Shanghai. Since the start of the pandemic in 2020, he and his wife have had to close their four other restaurants one by one. This sushi place, he says, is hanging on by a thread. Everyone's suffering this year, Zhang tells me. Our customers don't have as much income as before, so they're spending less. Including me, I'm spending less too. Bars and restaurants on this Shanghai street used to be packed every night, with people overflowing onto the sidewalks. Today, the only lines are people waiting for COVID tests. Economist Dan Wang says the unpredictable nature of the pandemic in China and the ensuing lockdowns have had a huge impact. She says businesses don't know how to plan ahead.
When they see one lockdown, they might want to wait it out. And once it's over, they will think, okay, maybe there's no next one. But this year, it's like one after another. So people have been waiting. And that kind of just stopped all kinds of investment. They just want to wait it out and see what's going to happen.
See what might happen, that is, after this week's Party Congress. Zhang Mancheng, the sushi restaurant owner, says he hopes the government will ease COVID restrictions soon. And maybe after this week, they might announce some economic stimulus for small businesses. But in a speech on Sunday, Chinese leader Xi Jinping once again stood behind his zero COVID policy. He made no mention of a stimulus plan for businesses. Dan Wang says the signs are clear.
The hope was after the Party Congress, the zero COVID policy would be greatly relaxed. But from the signals sent out so far, it's not going to happen.
Big cities like Shanghai and Beijing are feeling the brunt of the slowdown. But even in smaller places, there are signs of a struggling economy. Liu Juan owns a shoe store in a small town in central Henan province. Across the street, there are shops boarded up with for rent signs outside. These days, people are only willing to spend on absolute necessities, like food, she says. So if they don't need a new pair of shoes, they're not going to spend money. Liu and her family suffered another setback last year. Government policies forced her other business, an after-school tutoring center, to close. She says the family lost half its income. All the desks are still in the classrooms, she says. We're waiting to see whether we might be allowed to reopen. Others are not willing to wait. Fox Li runs a small foreign trade company in Beijing. He says he and his wife are preparing to leave China with their 5-year-old son. I'm not confident about China's future, he says. I'm worried about the economy and also about the political future of the country. He has sold the family's apartment and is preparing to apply for foreign citizenship. Li says he worries that after the Party Congress is over, things are going to get much worse. I want to leave China while we still can, he says, and not get caught up in the chaos. But for others, there's no such easy escape route. Back at the sushi restaurant, Zhang Mancheng and his wife say they don't have the resources to start over somewhere else. This year has been difficult, he says. Let's just wait and see whether next year is better. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
Architecture and how we design the places where we live can also have an impact on homelessness. That is the concept of a new multimedia exhibit out of Munich, Germany. It features models of social housing, photo essays, and documentary films. Daniel Telesnik is the curator of the show called Who's Next? Homelessness, Architecture in the City. Daniel, let's get right to it. How can architecture be a solution for homelessness?
Architecture as a discipline and as a profession has a lot to offer when called to the fore. Design as such, and if you understand design in its simplest terms, measures, for instance, the materials you choose to do a building, the organization of a building or of a housing complex, can do a lot to reintegrate people into housing. And there's a second dimension to houselessness, which is not only housing people that are in a houselessness situation, but actually helping them to stay housed.
So the title of the exhibition, Who's Next? What does that mean? What are you implying?
It's a provocation. but it's based also on observation of what's happening in cities around the world, that anybody can be houseless tomorrow. And this has to do with certain ideas that are very frequent in the US. This phrase, for example, I'm one paycheck away from being on the street. It's very real when you don't have unemployment insurance or things of the like. Things that in welfare systems like those that are in place in European cities perhaps are more distant as a thought. But still, we're seeing also that the situation is getting graver and graver in European cities all over. Take London, for instance. The situation is also out of control. Just perhaps the numbers are lower than in New York, Los Angeles, and other American cities. But compared to their own reality 10 years ago, they're seeing duplication of the numbers of people that are sleeping rough.
Why multiple media for this topic?
It is not unusual when you do an exhibition, an art exhibition, an architectural exhibition, that there is such a thing as an exhibition catalog. What is different is that many times in an art exhibition, the catalog is simply the illustration to show exactly what you're seeing in the exhibition. Take paintings, for instance, and their reproduction. In this case, the book that I edited has the added characteristic that we commissioned 8 essays to specialists coming from different fields, not only architects, but sociologists, lawyers, social workers, to reflect about some particular aspect of the crisis of houselessness.
After visiting your exhibit, Daniel, how will people see the problems of the unhoused differently?
I'm hoping that people learn a lot about what the realities, plural, of being unhoused are. It is a topic or a reality that is in plain sight, but that we usually tend to almost like visually correct, right? When somebody sleeps in the streets or is panhandling in the street, and we just kind of edit them out of our vision. So in a way to bring attention and to make that visible.
Daniel Telesnik is a curator of the traveling exhibition Who's Next? Homelessness, Architecture, and the City, which originated in Munich, Germany. He joined us today from his busy office in London. Daniel, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you so much.
One of the most gut-wrenching moments from the war in Ukraine was the discovery of atrocities in the city of Bucha. The evidence there prompted widespread calls for accountability. Many war crimes experts have traveled to the city to investigate. One of Bucha's deputy mayors is now digitizing information about the dead that could help with prosecutions. Dina Temple-Rest, and of the podcast Click Here, has a story.
Mass graves offend something deep in the human conscience. I think it's because they fly in the face of our instinct to honor the dead. I'd always assumed mass graves were the work of perpetrators, a kind of ham-handed effort to cover up unspeakable crimes. But in Ukraine, that's only half the story.
Here in Bucha, we have different kind of mass graves.
That's Mahilia Skorek-Shaviska, the deputy mayor of Bucha, a leafy bedroom community just 15 miles from Kyiv. And she says that many of the Russian-occupied cities in Ukraine had local people dig the mass graves themselves. It was to prevent disease or to stop stray dogs from desecrating the bodies.
The biggest mass grave near the St. Andrew Church.
Church of St. Andrew. It's in the center of Bucha. That mass grave was the work of municipal and hospital employees. Bucha was still under Russian occupation when they began to dig.
Russians allow them to do temporary cemetery, so they digged big trench and put like, they are saying about 67 bodies.
Eventually, there would be hundreds of bodies, which means someone had to put a name to a face and then a body, and it was a huge logistical challenge.
So you have to bury them, even without documents. And when you did it without the documents, you have to dig them out.
In a sense, Bucha's dead were only put in the ground for safekeeping and to preserve evidence. And then there's the second kind of mass grave, the kind that Ukrainians actually stumble upon unexpectedly in the forest or on the outskirts of town. Those mass graves are crime scenes.
There was mass graves where Russians executed people, digged the holes in the graves and hide them.
To keep track of all the DNA samples, establish cause of death, and gather evidence of possible war crimes, someone has to organize millions of little digital clues. And it fell to Shaviska, a one-time digital innovator for the mayor of Bucha, to build a system to modernize something she'd never expected to modernize. a way to account for the debt.
Our system was not able to manage such a big amount of requests, looking for the bodies or looking for the disappeared people, and of course, to recognize the corpse.
They had police databases, missing persons reports, photographs of the disappeared. The problem was, all these little clues were siloed. There was no central repository, no single database to search. Shaviska came to find out that even Ukraine's morgues were mostly pen and paper operations. Digitizing their records was something they'd always intended to do, but never got around to. Shaviska decided it was time to change all that.
And we received data from 5 morgues, and we created the primary database.
The primary database ingested information the morgues had collected about the 400 bodies they'd examined, but didn't have room to keep. Not just sex and approximate age and hair color, but also the source of identifying clues that might help families find their loved ones. Tattoos, birthmarks, scars. Shaviska then helped families cross-reference that information with special telegram channels and police databases that laid out who went into which mass graves and where. The idea was that when the families arrived with details about their missing relatives, Shaviska knew exactly where to look. The system cleared the way for families to honor the dead and provide proper burials, which is what they're using it for now. Where it might be even more helpful later is in helping prosecutors knit together millions of digital clues to hold the guilty accountable.
Building a war crimes case is quite different than building a normal, you know, violent crime case.
That's Ambassador Stephen Rapp. He's been involved in war crimes prosecutions in Rwanda, Sierra Leone, and Syria.
Most violent crimes may involve some planning, but they're over and done with. They're like a bank robbery in a few minutes. And you can control the crime scene, and you can take advantage of video cameras.
In Bucha, crimes were committed over 32 days, all over the city. And while social media posts and CCTV and secret iPhone videos recorded by witnesses can all help connect perpetrators to a crime, finding those witnesses in a city of 30,000 at a time of war so they can testify at trial many years later only begins to explain why war crimes trials are so complicated. Rapp says the bodies themselves provide clues as to what happened, but they can't tell the whole story.
Then the issue becomes, who committed those crimes? Who's really responsible? Were they rogue units, scared young soldiers who just acted out their own impulses? Or was that part of a strategy in which the military command really looked to intimidate the population?
Rapp says war crimes are really committed by organizations, not individuals.
And then you have to figure out how to attribute criminal responsibility across that organization and prove, ideally, you know, the responsibility of people who really made the crime happen.
People who ordered the bombardment of civilian targets in Ukraine. People who told soldiers to show no mercy to the residents of occupied cities. Rapp is advising the Ukrainian government on how it might organize those trials. He says they need to be structured and systematic to bring speedier justice. In the meantime, he says, Russian President Vladimir Putin isn't doing himself any favors. By not having court-martials or investigations when news of fresh atrocities surface, he makes it easier to follow those crimes up the chain.
Indeed, Putin giving awards to at least one of the major units involved there as sort of heroes and defenders of the fatherland, you know, you can in fact impute responsibility all the way up to him, potentially.
Which is what Deputy Mayor Shaviska wants.
In 1 year, in 2 years, maybe in 3 years' time, we will have not only the names and the data from the morgue, but also the results of the investigations.
As Bucha emerges from the Russian occupation, Shaviska is making those accommodations you have to make when you're at war. She carries her smartphone everywhere now because Bucha has instituted a new missile warning system. It sounds like one of those amber alerts we get on our phones here.
So that's the signal that you should hide from another possible attack. My little son, he's 7 years old. He's all the time talking about killing the Putin, about Russians as enemies.
He builds pillow forts to protect them both now, and has taken to singing Ukrainian patriotic songs. Sometimes, they sing them together. Neither the glory nor the will of Ukraine has died yet, they sing. We will give body and soul for our freedom. For the world, I'm Dina Temple-Rasta.
Dina is the host of the Click Here podcast about all things cyber and intelligence. It's produced by Sean Powers and Will Jarvis. You can hear an extended version of the story wherever you get your podcasts. It has been more than a month since protests began across Iran, sparked when a young woman died after being detained by police for breaking Iran's strict dress code. Many Iranians have been calling for their leaders to step down. It is a movement led by women and girls. Reporter Fariba Nawa has the story of three generations of protesters and what's bringing each of them out into the streets of Tehran. For safety reasons, the women have asked us to use only their initials.
MB is a 35-year-old writer and performance artist. Her art has taken her all over Iran. She's been part of other protest movements, like the 2009 Green Revolution. She says this time feels different. It's the most inclusive of class, gender, ethnicity, and religion that she's ever seen. She says the movement doesn't have a leadership, which is its strength, so the government can't arrest leaders like they did with other uprisings. Earlier this month, the call came out on social media during the few hours internet is allowed for a gathering at 2 p.m. The protest was next to where she works, and there are a lot of universities nearby. So students began to congregate. It was a scene from a war zone, she says. Authorities were directing people to side streets so they could grab and beat them behind alleyways. They had white bands, and they would detain girls and women. I got hit by their batons. That's when MB went into her office. She says people were trying to take cover and go wherever there was an open door or passage for safety. Some of these people had sought safety in our building. The smell of tear gas was coming through the cracks, and it was choking us. Then I went upstairs. I entered my workplace, and there were three of us, and we locked the door. This is from a video MB sent me that day as she hid from authorities. Police had followed protesters to her building. They were going door to door, banging with batons, then taking anyone they suspected to jail. MB holds her phone camera still as she looks through the peephole of her office door. There are loud noises behind the door. You hear people shouting. She paces with the phone around her office. She tells her two women colleagues, Don't scream. If you're scared, don't scream. Remain calm. One of the other women is on her phone, and a man on speaker is telling her, don't do anything. You can hear MB breathing heavily as she walks, peeking out the window, and then again through the peephole. Police reach her door. But no one answers. We thought now they're coming to break the door, to rape us, to kill us. But in the end, the noise stopped, and there was silence in the building. We waited until sunset, then my husband picked me up. It was a very scary and bitter day. MB says she'll go back on the streets, but younger Iranian women are willing to take more risks. GT is 28 years old and was raised as an only child. She works in marketing and says her fight about women's rights is not just with the government. GT says she's striking back against superstitions and outdated religious traditions, including some members of her own family. She says, again and again, I've been stopped in the university and told my skirt is too short, to take off my nail polish, and then with my own family to wear a headscarf out of respect for someone. But what about respect for me? GT says she headed out with a headscarf in her hand alone on her first day of protest. Cars honked their horns in support of her hair showing. She joined a group of women and police started shooting in the air. An older woman was shot and her blood flowed under GT's feet. She went home panicked but returned for the next protest. The average age of most detained protesters is 15. Teenagers want a future that guarantees their individual rights, like DL, a 17-year-old high school graduate. She's a fashion model, but underground, because her job involves showing her hair, and that's illegal. DL says our demands are for a better economy, and as a woman, to have legal rights. If we get married, the right to divorce should be ours. Women are banned from riding bicycles, from becoming judges. Their testimony is given half the credibility of a man's in court. Women in Iran say to live freely, they have to break the law. And that's another form of protest. Wearing the hijab is not that important because we already don't wear it, she says. We already go to parties. We already drink alcohol and have boyfriends. DL says there's a lot of rage, as well as solidarity among teen girls. She's encouraged to protest when she sees Iranian women who wear headscarves supporting girls who don't. MB, GT, and DL all say this. The feeling among protesters is that there's no going back to the way things were. For the world, this is Fari Banawa.
Here's an update on a story we brought you earlier this month. The Plain Language Bill has been making its way through New Zealand's parliament. As the name implies, the bill would make government officials scrap the jargon in their public-facing documents, you know, making things easier for regular folk to understand. Parliamentarian Rachel Boyack is the one behind the bill. She made her final argument earlier today.
We have a democratic right to be able to understand this information. When government agencies are explaining services, benefits, or how to comply with requirements, they should use plain language and avoid jargon.
After one last debate, the final votes came in.
The question is that the motion be agreed to. Those of that opinion will say aye.
Aye.
To the contrary, no.
No.
The ayes have it.
The bill passed with 76 ayes and 42 noes. To become law, it next needs to be signed by the Governor General, who has already voiced approval for this bill. Opponents, though, say they won't back down.
This is a stupid piece of legislation. It doesn't actually fix anything.
Simeon Brown, a member of the National Party, has been a vocal critic of the bill since it was introduced last year. He says it's a big waste of time, and the goal of the bill could have been achieved, he says, by sending a reminder email to government agencies.
Please use plain language in your documents. Now, that's not many words.
Brown told Parliament his party will repeal the bill if they win the next election. Repeal. Now, there's a word everyone understands. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you again tomorrow.
From PRX.